Escape Pod 6. June 16, 2005. Today's story, Jenny Nettles, by Deborah Doyle and James D. McDonald.
Hi again, everyone. Welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely. I got a surprising email a few days ago from a guy in California. He was a Sunday school teacher at a Methodist church. Now, normally if I get an email from someone like that, I try to remember what I said. This time the guy wanted to know if I was the guy with the pink unicorn quote, because he wanted to teach it to his kids. I remember exactly what he meant. See, back in the mid-90s, I was a smart-ass college student, and we were goofing around with made-up religions. Someone brought up an old saw from, I think, the alt.atheism news group about how you could make up a totally consistent religion about invisible pink unicorns. So naturally, we just had to try it. We created a manifesto of the faith of the invisible pink unicorn. We had a lot of silliness in it, like how invisible pink unicorns poke unbelievers and make them think they're mosquito bites, and how they're responsible for all the lost socks in the world. But the cornerstone of the whole thing is a precept that I wrote near the very beginning of the document. It said, "Invisible pink unicorns are beings of great spiritual power. We know this because they are capable of being invisible and pink at the same time. Like all religions, the faith of the invisible pink unicorns is based upon both logic and faith. We have faith that they are pink. We logically know that they're invisible because we can't see them." I have somehow become mildly famous for this. I'm not kidding. When I Google my own name, that quote shows up in a lot of places. Mostly atheist pages, which I find funny because I'm not an atheist. It's even in Wikipedia. Look up invisible pink unicorns and see for yourself. And now, I discover from this guy that I'm cited, with attribution, on page 20 of the standard Methodist curriculum, "Do Science and the Bible Conflict?" by Judson Poling. I am a quoted religious scholar. This totally makes my week. So, my advice for anyone else who wants to start a religion, I'm talking to you, Evo, is, if you want it to catch on, don't try too hard. Just say something funny, and if you give it a few years, the world will independently decide that it's deep. And, speaking of deep, today's story happens on the ocean. It's a straight-up ghost story by master storytellers Deborah Doyle and James D. McDonald. They're the authors of more than 30 novels, including the terrific Mage Worlds books, the award-winning Young Adult Night's Weird and Circle of Magic series, and a whole lot more. They were also two of my instructors several years back at the Viable Paradise Writing Workshop in Martha's Vineyard, so I considered it a real honor to be able to present one of their stories. This one comes from Bruce Coville's Book of Spine Tinglers, edited by, you'll never guess, Bruce Coville. So, reef the foresails and batten the hatches. It's story time. Jenny Nettles, by Deborah Doyle and James D. McDonald. On October the 4th of the year 1773, the brigantine Jenny Nettles, merchantman out of New Bedford, made port. No sooner was she tied up than the crew was at work with block and tackle, with hammer and chisel, unshipping the figurehead. They lifted it up and swung it ashore, the carved and painted wooden statue of a woman in Highland garb, and laid it down on the pier. Then, six men on either side, they carried it shoulder high to the nearest churchyard. They dug a grave, lowered the figurehead in, and said the words from the book. When they were done, they filled in the grave, set up crosses at the head and foot, and returned to the ship without a word. None of the crew ever shipped in Jenny Nettles again, and more than one of them left the sea for good after that voyage. But not a soul among them would ever say why. She was built in Halifax in 1755, and christened Jenny Fraser. The owner was a Scotsman, a Fraser of Strathglass. In the bloody year of 45, when the Scottish clans rose up against the crown of England, John Fraser was a new married man. With a wife to keep and a child on the way, he stayed out of the fighting. He obtained a certificate of immunity, an official paper showing that he had never fought against King George II, and after the uprising ended in bitter defeat for the rebels at the Battle of Culloden, he trusted in the certificate to protect him from King George's soldiers. But the red-coat troops who came through Glenmoriston and Strathglass cared nothing for a scrap of paper. He was a Highlander, and that was enough. He was taken prisoner as a rebel and a traitor, and sent to the hulks, the prison ships anchored in the River Thames. There he remained for the best part of a year, while he and the hundreds of others who shared the rotting holds of the prison ships grew thinner by the day until their bones could all be seen. Many died. The corpses were removed only when enough of them had accumulated to make it worthwhile to hire beggars to haul them out. After an endless time when the only light he saw was a square patch of blue in the deck above, John Fraser and his fellow prisoners were hauled out on the deck, divided into groups of 20, and forced to choose lots. One man in each 20 was hanged. The rest were transported, sent to England's colonies in America, with no hope of ever returning home. John Fraser had come to Halifax unwillingly, but he prospered there as he had never done in his native Scotland. In time he became a wealthy merchant, but he never forgot the wife and child he had lost when King George's soldiers came killing and looting their way through Glencannock. And when he built his first ship, it was christened Jenny Fraser in his wife's name. Jenny Fraser was a sweet sailor and had lucky passages, bringing good fortune to her owner and to those who sailed in her. But the time came when John Fraser died in Halifax, of weariness after a hard life as much as from any mortal illness, and the Jenny passed into other hands. In 1764, Jenny Fraser was sold for the first time, and in 1768 she was sold again. The first buyer kept the old name, seeing no point in changing what the ship had done well with, but the second, a New Bedford Yankee, had no great liking for another merchant's name on a thing that was his. Nor did he care for wasting ceremony on an object of wood and hemp and canvas. He had the old name painted over and a new one lettered on the sternboard, all without a proper christening, and the ship was called Jenny Nettles from that day on. By 1773, when she left Liverpool for New Bedford with a cargo of Irish linen, fine china, and cotton manufactured goods, no one aboard the brigantine remembered that she had ever been called anything else. Halfway through the voyage, the wind died. On the same day, a white bird flew out of the east and circled the Jenny's mainmast 3 times, crying mournfully. The crew saw it and began to mutter among themselves. Some of them were restless in their minds already, since the owner had put a new captain over them for this voyage. His name was Pym, a dour man, from Suffolk in England, thick-set and grizzle-haired. Captain Pym had come to the sea later in life, instead of being brought up to it from boyhood, like most of the Jenny's crew. He had a scar on one cheek, like a saber cut, making some people guess that he'd taken the king's shilling in his days as a landsman, and had fought in King George's wars. Perhaps it was for this reason that he was not greatly loved by the common sailors, or perhaps it was only that he was not a New Bedford man. When no wind had blown for 3 days, the crew began to speak of ill luck and weather witches.
"There was a time," said Big Tom, the foretopman, "that I shipped on a vessel with a Finlander aboard. He said he was a German, sometimes said he was Dutch, but that was a lie. He was a Finn. He kept all the winds of the world in a little leather bag, and he could let him out or keep him in as he had the desire."
"Are you saying there's a Finlander among us?" asked another sailor.
"No, we're all New Bedford men, but if I wanted to see home again, I'd look for a bag of wind."
And look they did, but no bag of wind did they find, even though they searched the Jenny from truck to keel, save only the captain's cabin, and shifted all her ballast stones. On the 5th day, the sun rose pale through fog. Not a whisper of wind came to ripple the surface of the ocean, or to blow the mist away.
"It's time one of us did something," said Big Tom.
He strode back to the Jenny's mainmast and stuck his knife into the wood. Captain Pym loomed out of the fog behind him.
"What is this mummery, sir?"
Big Tom wasn't a man to show fear, even of the captain.
"There's bad luck on board," he said, "and I'll do something about it if I can."
The captain looked at him, scowling.
"Will you, then?"
"Aye," said Tom, undaunted. "If sticking my knife into the mast doesn't bring us a wind, then I'll whistle out loud until we get one."
"You do that, Tom," the captain said. "You just do that. Mind you don't find more wind than you wanted."
Captain Pym turned and walked aft again. Big Tom waited until the captain was gone back to his cabin, then went on forward, padding on bare, calloused feet along the fog-wet deck. He made his way out onto the Jenny's bowsprit, holding on to her forestay as he went. When Big Tom was as far out on the bowsprit as he could get, he held on to the stay with one hand and commenced to whistle. He whistled until his lips grew raw and his throat grew sore, while below him the water heaved low and oily, and the ship barely moved in the thick groundswell.
After a while, he paused to take breath, and in the silence he heard a voice, a woman's voice, when he knew there was no woman aboard, speaking to him from some place close behind him.
"It'll do you no good."
Tom turned and looked, but he saw no one. Once again he started whistling, and again the woman's voice said,
"It'll do you no good."
He looked again, but still he saw no one there. He wet his lips and swallowed hard and began to whistle for the third time. This time he whistled hymn tunes, he who hadn't darkened a church door since he'd gone to sea. And a third time the woman's voice said to him,
"I tell you truly, man, it'll do you no good at all."
The calm dragged on. Every knife aboard was stuck in the Jenny's mainmast, but still they had no wind. The fog that wrapped itself about the brigantine was thick and dirty-looking, like uncarded wool, and by the seventh day there was no fresh water left aboard.
"There's a full ton of water in the afterhold,"
said Big Tom, when the ship's cook brought the word to the crew.
"Taste it yourself," said the cook. "It's all salt."
"How did seawater get into the water casks?"
"I didn't say it was seawater," the cook told him. "I said that it was salt."
2 days passed after the Jenny ran out of fresh water. The bottom of the scuttlebutt was all of green moss, and no water remained in the barrel for the dipper to scoop up.
"How long will a man live without water?" asked the ship's boy.
6 days, said Big Tom. "Sometimes 8. Most of 'em go mad first, or drink seawater, and that kills 'em."
"Seawater?"
"Aye. It's poison, you know, full of the devil's salt. But men drink it sometimes when the thirst is on 'em."
He turned back to the rail, looking off into the glowing fog. The ship creaked as it rolled in the swell, but no waves disturbed the flat calm. On the fourth day after the water ran out, the Jenny's sails dripped with moisture, but it was salt, a bitter brine, and impossible to drink. A faint green mold grew on everything, on the masts and shrouds, on the sails, even on the sailors' clothes, and at night the sails shone with a sickly phosphorescent sheen. At 3 bells of the mid-watch, with the starboard watch on deck, the fog was as thick as ever. The ship's boy was on the lookout, but on this night there was nothing to see. No stars overhead, no horizon, only the clammy fog wrapping all around them. The darkness was black indeed, as dark high above the deck as locked in the lower hold, and he'd needed to find his way up to the masthead by feel. All the Jenny's sails were set, but they hung limp and useless in the flat calm, waiting for a wind that never came. Then, off to port, the ship's boy saw a light. Not a natural light, but the bluish glow of St. Elmo's fire, hovering near the end of the yard.
"On deck!" the boy shouted. "On deck! Ahoy!"
No answer came from below, and the fog swallowed his words. Out of the darkness the light shone, pale blue and beckoning. He knew that he shouldn't do it, but he took hold of the yard, swung down to the foot ropes, and made his way outboard. The light on the yard's end grew larger and larger the closer he came, until at last he saw that it wasn't St. Elmo's fire at all, but a woman sitting and weeping, holding a tiny bundle of cloth in her lap. The woman looked up, and he saw the tears streaming down her face.
"Who'll give me back my bonnie wee bairn?"
she asked. The boy lost his grip on the fog-slick jackstay and fell. Big Tom found the ship's boy by stumbling over him in the dark. The lad had broken his back in his fall from the yard, and it took him some hours to die. During the whole time, he raved in his pain, talking of murdered women and burnt-out farms and laughing soldiers with bloody swords. Toward the last, he grew quiet. At 8 bells of the day-watch, he was buried at sea, wrapped in a piece of sailcloth with 40 feet of chain sewed at his feet. On the morning after his death, a clear fluid began to leak from the Jenny's mainmast, slow, glistening droplets that curled out and ran downward from where the knives were stuck in the wood.
"It's water," said the ship's cook, "but not fresh. Salt, like blood."
"Not like blood,"
said Big Tom, who had also tasted it. His cheeks were sunken, and his eyes were hollow and dark.
"Not like blood, like tears."
Captain Pym came from his cabin at last, at 6 bells of the forenoon watch, with a brace of pistols in his hands. He'd tasted no water for 5 days either, for the Jenny's water casks were held in common, but he kept wine and whiskey enough in his cabin that thirst wasn't what had driven him mad. His eyes were red-rimmed and his face unshaven, and he wore about his neck a bit of polished silver hanging from a chain, the badge of a sergeant in King George's Redcoat Army.
He staggered forward through the fog, past the waist where the ship's boy had fallen, past the mainmast stuck with the knives and the slow tears weeping from the wood, out past the windlass and the cat heads up to the very peak of the bow. There he climbed out on the chains, beneath the bowsprit, and stood face to face with the brigantine's figurehead, the greater-than-life-size carving of a young woman dressed in tartan cloth that stood on the Jenny's cutwater, her painted gray eyes staring ever outward.
"Damn you!" the captain cried. "Stop the dreams!"
He fired one of his pistols into the figurehead's breast. For a moment longer he stood there with the powder smoke hanging about him. No wind stirred the air to carry it away. At last he said in a low, almost sobbing voice,
"How many times do I have to kill you before you'll stay dead?"
And with that word he placed the muzzle of the second pistol beneath his jaw and fired. His body fell down and away into the still water. The report of the shot had hardly died, muffled in the heavy fog, before the crew of the Jenny heard the distant roaring of the coming wind. Faint at first, then loud, the wind came nearer and nearer, rushing in at them with fearful speed until the ship heeled over as it struck, a gale so strong that it ripped the last shreds of fog away and bellied the sails, which had so long hung limp, so that the canvas stood out full and fair. The fog scattered, but black clouds covered the sky. A thunderbolt cracked. An instant later the rain began pelting down. A torrent of fresh water that filled all the catchment basins on the cabin roof and washed away the smells of brine and thirst. Lashed by the wind, the ocean, only a moment ago so flat and still, broke into foaming spray. The Jenny's bow wave curled up in a froth of white as the wind drove her onward. The captain's body passed down the port side before fading from sight astern. After it had vanished completely, a white seabird circled three times around the mainmast of the brigantine Jenny Nettles, once named Jenny Fraser, after a young woman who had been killed by King George's soldiers outside a burning cottage on the dark slopes of Glencannock, and then flew away again into the darkening west. And there's today's escape pod. We hope you enjoyed it. By now you know what to do. escape.extraneous.org, comment box, submit button. If you live in Atlanta, Georgia, and you don't read the website but just listen to the show, here's some important news for you. We're giving away a pair of tickets to the preview screening of Serenity, this is the Firefly movie, on June 23rd. It's a trivia contest. Go to the website to find out more. If you don't live near Atlanta, or you're listening to this in the year 2017, I'm sorry for wasting 10 seconds of your life. No, you can't have them back.
Hi, my name is Anna, and I am calling from Atlanta, Georgia. I am reviewing The Secret Country by Pamela Dean. It is the first volume in her The Secret Country trilogy. One of my favorite novels, The Dubious Hills, is by Pamela Dean, so I eagerly picked up The Secret Country. It follows the adventures of four kids who usually spend the summer playing a fantasy political game slash play that they made up that they call The Secret Country. Then, one summer, they are transported into the secret country, and they realize the story is real, and that things aren't following what happened in their game, and that the secret country and its people have taken on a life of their own. Unfortunately, I found the novel very hard to follow. There were too many protagonists and too many point of view shifts. The political intrigue wasn't explained very well, and was usually reduced to, "This isn't what I remembered," comments from one of the four kids. Overall, I rate this book a pass. Instead, pick up a copy of Dean's The Dubious Hills and enjoy this much superior work.
Thanks, Anna. I'll second that Dubious Hills recommendation. If you've got a book you'd like to review or revile, call our comments line at 206-666-EPOD and tell the world what you think. I want to give special thanks to Ken Newquist of Nuketown and Paul Jenkins of the Rev Up Review podcast, both of whom gave great in-depth and thoughtful reviews of Escape Pod this week. Both of you rock, you're both on my pod list, and I've got links on our website for anyone who's looking for some great SF commentary. Remember, as always, Escape Pod is a listener-supported podcast. We pay our authors every week, and we rely on your generosity to keep bringing you good work. If you like what you heard this week, please click on our PayPal link and give just a little. I tell you honestly, if every listener gave $5 just once, we could go years before asking you again.
Escape Pod is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. This means that if you don't mess with it and you don't use it in your Pepsi commercial, it's totally free. Do we live in a cool world or what? Of course, all other rights are reserved to our authors, and that's also cool. The music is by Daikaiju. Yes, they really wear kabuki masks on stage, and very big hats, and they rock. Hear them at daikaiju.org. Until next week, have fun. And shh, the unicorns are listening.